Hello and welcome to this week's The Mad Tech Podcast. You have me, Lindsay Rowntree. I am head of content at Exchange Y, and I'm joined, of course, by Kieran O'Kane, our CEO.
Hello.
Hello. And our guest this week, I'm delighted to welcome Gareth Holmes, who's recently taken the role of CEO UK at Seen This. Welcome, Gareth.
Good morning.
And so this is our final podcast 2018. So it's a good opportunity for us to do a year in review. It's been quite a big year in the world of ad tech. There's been a lot of things, you know, GDPR being a big story, kind of blockchain, the talk of the town, big trends towards direct to consumer. I mean, the moving on from AI, Facebook, Google in general. There's a lot to talk about. Where do you want to start?
I don't know. Where should we start?
Well, let's talk about the big thing that everyone was ramping up to in May and then kind of what the impact of that's been since May. GDPR.
Oh,
25th of May 2018, a day etched in everyone's brains.
So I would use the word nebulous because it seems to be a very popular word.
Because you've learnt the word recently, yeah, is what you're actually saying.
So a reference to Brexit, I would say that GDPR is just as nebulous as Brexit is. It is a riddle within a conundrum, within a box of some sort. It's still a messy situation. What's happened since May? Who knows? I haven't seen many sites in compliance with the current law. I've seen sites do stuff, but whether or not it's in the spirit of the law or it adheres to the ruling itself, who knows? And obviously with the IAB tech framework still a nebulous project, because it is nebulous because it doesn't seem to have had Google's buy-in yet, it's still up in the air. Nobody's gone to jail. No one's been fined. But there are privacy advocates like Johnny Ryan and his ilk who are obviously trying to push it. But we all know that Johnny walks are brave and he's got his own personal agenda. Use these tokens on my new browser. But who knows? It's going to be an interesting 2019. I would say still a mess.
So we need to find you a new word outside of nebulous.
Yes, nebulous.
Yes.
I think what's interesting about GDPR is GDPR became law 2 years before May. It only became enforceable on the 25th of May this year. So whilst the market talks about this is new, you know, we aren't prepared, that the entire world has had 2 years to prep for GDPR becoming enforceable on the 25th of May. Interestingly, when talking to publishers and talking to agencies, how many haven't appointed a data protection officer? Which is fascinating when we've all had 2 years to get ready for it, for the enforcement, but when you're talking across the market, no one specifically, but when you're talking across the market asking about who's filling these roles, it's still the commercial people that are making a lot of the decisions based on compliance, particularly in the UK.
So you are seeing that. You're not seeing the wealth of DPOs, which is part of the legislation. You have to have a data protection officer within your business of a certain size, of a certain traffic, etc.
Lindsay's our DPO.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, very delighted to be as well. But you've seen there's not that many actually in play, or they're not roles.
I think they are now. I think what's been interesting is the division between compliance and commercial. Within the GDPR, it does spell out that the DPO cannot report into, I believe this is accurate, cannot report into the commercial arm of a business, whereas a lot of the decisions regarding compliance seem to be being or have been taken by commercial people. The challenge there is that, as we all know, and it's not a lot of people are talking about it, GDPR is damaging to how the business runs today with regard to third-party data, consent or lack therein, who's consenting. You know, let's look at the framework. There's a massive capture of consented data. Flag signals are being passed within, you know, bid strings in the programmatic environment. However, we are now seeing, to Kieran's point earlier with Dr. Johnny Ryan, those guys are taking action based on what they believe to be a perverse application.
But it's their interpretation of the law, because the law is not as clear-cut, and it's not clear-cut, it's very nebulous.
And please, please find a new word. But before we get GDPR advocates down our backs, technically it's not a law, it's a regulation.
Okay.
Because I always get done for this.
All right, so it's a regulation. Look, GDPR is the first step towards a first party war, right? The end of the cookie is nigh, right? It is inevitable, right? We've had, this is just a, if you think about where this leads, right? GDPR has been very damaging to independent ad tech. Let's put it that way. Publishers, independent ad tech that have a reliance on a third-party cookie. Now, nobody's noticed over the last 12 months that Google has been moving all of its various ad tech propositions to one platform, one cookie to rule them all, right? So Google basically can opt us in, because we all use Google products, right? Opt us in for one cookie. So it's the first-party cookie that rules them all. GDPR has been a gift to Facebook, Google, and Amazon. It's been an absolute gift, open goal. And while I applaud the European Union's attempt to protect user privacy, the cookie's not the problem. The problem is you've got 3-4 companies that control our entire ecosystem. And I would like those two things to be addressed in tandem. But where we're going with this is I see this as a first-party world, right? It's going to be, you're either going to have really rich first-party data or you're going to work on a contextually targeted basis, right? So you could argue there's a rumor going around, it has been confirmed or denied by Google, but Google are going to introduce an ITP as a standard on their browser, right? Chromecast has 65% of the entire market in desktop and mobile, right? That means that for independent ad tech, the ability...
To clarify, you mean Chrome, not Chromecast, right?
Chrome, not Chromecast, yeah. Sorry. Chrome and Chromium, is that whatever the engine they're built off?
Chromium, yeah.
Yeah. Has 65% of the market, and probably more because that's where Internet Explorer is going as well. Microsoft announced yesterday they're going to build off the back of it, right? So you now have a market, addressable market of 70%, maybe more, 71% of the entire European desktop mobile market is controlled by one company, right? Who now have decided we're going to turn off third-party cookies. What that means for retargeting is, it's obvious. You know, Criteo were hit hard because of Safari. What would them and other companies who use retargeting as a targeting mechanism, what are they going to do when Google turns it off? So the third-party cookie is slowly being killed off. So now we as an ecosystem are going to head towards a first-party world. And I think that's really interesting.
I mean, we had Martin Kelly from Infectious Media here the other week talking about the fact that, you know, from an agency perspective, working with clients, GDPR has been a massive, massive boon for Google and Facebook because it's allowed them to double down and become even more enclosed and lay blame to GDPR and say, because of GDPR, we have to be even more protective of our data, of our assets, blah, blah, blah. And it's made it more difficult for the likes of agencies trying to work with different technologies, different areas out in the ecosystem outside of Google and Facebook. Actually, the easy thing to do is just put more money in Google and Facebook because at least you know that their measurement is good and whatever else.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Kieran, you've talked a lot this year about kind of the case of the 20 percenters. What do things like that in 2019 mean for those 20 percenters?
I think it's going to be rough. I mean, I wrote a piece about the unintended consequences of GDPR. This is one of the biggest ones. You're just basically giving the power back to Facebook. And if I'm a marketer, I couldn't blame marketers for saying, I want something addressable, something compliant, that I'm not going to end up in a court of law over, right? So Facebook is a first-party domain, as is Google, even though Google's...
Both are being sued, just for the record.
That's true, but...
non-compliance with GDPR.
Absolutely.
I would bet serious money on the sort of legal ability of both of those companies to beat down a couple of crazy privacy advocates. And I put crazy in event occur because that's not true, but I'm saying privacy advocates who have a right to push these companies. But Google and Facebook will be fine. It's the smaller businesses that cannot afford a legal team or political clout that can face this off.
Yeah, I think what we haven't seen is proactivity from the 20 percenters. You know, GDPR, as I said earlier, was coming in over 2.5 years ago. I think one initiative that looks like it's cracking on is Ozone, the publisher partnership. They're looking to create a single ID to be able to...
Smart.
Of course it's smart. To work across their properties rather than just an amalgamation of media. They're looking to, and they have created their own ad tech. They didn't go out to market to look for a solution. Why? Well, sovereignty is important to those people. We are now finally seeing people understand that sovereignty is everything, rather than, hey, you look after my stuff and I'll pretend I've got control. These guys and girls have taken control through the Ozone Project, or the Ozone Partnership. I'm not sure what its official term is.
I mean, the thing I like about Ozone is that it is proactivity, right? If you have a single ID for all of the premium publishers in the UK, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, those newspapers, mostly newspaper groups,
yeah,
are probably the go-to destination for most of the population in this country, right? Quality premium context versus user-generated content bullshit on the platforms, which predominantly it is. YouTube and Facebook are mostly UGC, right? We're talking about Trend. It's a great initiative. And I think that sort of collective around a single ID would be massively helpful for our industry. A, it would help those publishers that are struggling to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
And B, it would give agencies more of a choice, marketers more of a choice to put their money elsewhere. I'm sure there's a lot of marketers that feel very uncomfortable piling a lot of money into Facebook when they know that a lot of the content is crap, right? It's like you stand back from Facebook. It effectively is the ultimate message board, right? It's just reams of comments on a page, updates. It's rubbish.
Well, it's just UGC.
Yeah.
And you know, you can remember back to when we had the IASH days, and UGC was auto cross for no, we're not going to run there. Facebook is UGC. End of story.
It is 100%.
And what I think's interesting is the key to any consortia or partnership is replicating what marketers can do once they step into the Facebook environment. They, you know, scale is absolutely important, but as is ease of executing a campaign and addressability, the buyer's definition of an audience or a quantifiable definition of an audience with measurability,
yeah,
and measurability that the marketer can interact with. You don't have that ability within Facebook.
Yeah, and also if the 20% could come together and form a single ID or a means to basically match up, so someone like ID5 being able to match first party cookies and actually roping it together, then that 20% is more open to measurability and giving data back to marketers. And marketers will vote with their feet. They're going, I'm getting more from these guys, and this includes TV and radio, and I want to work with these guys because they're giving me more insight on how I spend my money. But at the minute, we've got a fractured, balkanized ecosystem. That's what it feels like to me. You've got different factions trying to build their own stuff, whereas an IAB sponsored neutral ID would be fantastic at the browser level. Imagine if you had that at the browser level. That means that would be a GDPR compliant means to do that. I feel that we're not being creative enough. We're working in bits and bobs,
I think we are working in bits and bobs, but I also think we're working in the past. We're not looking to the future for a solution. If users have to give consent, therefore it is a law or a regulation, that must be central to any ID solution. Therefore, a privacy by design ID mechanism or technology should be core to any consortium. Because it's all well and good having a single ID, but who is to say and how can publishers prove that each time an ad is served, that is to a consented user? Facebook's lucky they can hide behind their T's and C's as they're doing currently in the press and saying everybody said yes to everything. Fine, that's one for the courts. However, publishers need to be able to leverage their own compliance to prove a point of difference with marketers on what they're doing, how they're looking to the future to combat, you know, becoming a 19% or an 18% or a 10% as we move forward.
Mm.
But then I guess, you know, obviously talking about kind of the single ID, the unique ID, even the shared ID, which is kind of the alternative of is a single ID, a route that we can't necessarily go down. From a demand side, how would you then kind of, whose responsibility is it to kind of then make that happen? It's all well and good this being created. But if your standard advertiser is still just finds it the easiest thing to do is just shove the money in Google and Facebook, how do you then bring that together so that you can get the agencies and the advertisers, the smart ones and the ones that need some education, to work to understand that this is the future and this is where we need to go?
The only organization that can make this happen is the IAB, collectively, because we need a collective response to this. It should be easier. It should be so much easier to buy programmatic through our ecosystem. It is not. Hence the route why we've got multitude of ID and cookie syncing tools that we're trying to rope it all together. Whereas Facebook and Google just make it so easy. Facebook is, a child could run an ad on Facebook. It is so simple. And the granular targeting they have is phenomenal. Now, we run ads in Japan, you know, with Japanese creative, and it just works so well. So that's how easy it is. Imagine us trying to run a creative in the Japanese market through the programmatic ecosystem. It would take 4 or 5 steps. We need an agency. It's just we have overcomplicated our ecosystem to our detriment. Now, a lot of people want us to get our act together because they would rather a pluralistic ecosystem as opposed to 1 or 2 or 3 companies dominating everything. But we haven't got that far yet. And there's too much land grabbing going on. Oh, this is my space. I'm protecting it, blah, blah, blah. Rather than thinking about, well, we can grow the pie to 20%ers. Who would lose out in that situation? Google and Facebook, because they offer no value except for the fact that you can do that type of targeting within their ecosystem. Now, if we could replicate that, we've got premium. We've got quality content. Quality media, real content, not the shit that they have. And then, let's be honest, it is shit.
But then playing devil's advocate, would they lose out? I mean, we talked earlier about UGC and kind of UGC being, you know, the environment that Facebook basically operates in, and Google across many properties as well. On the flip side of that, you've got kind of the sell side and actually the industry in general talking about, you know, next year will be the year of quality content. That's how we need to focus, how we need to focus. But if advertisers are still happy to pump money into an area that's full of UGC, who cares? Is it really about quality content? And is that the answer? Is premium going to win?
I think it's a sociological problem. It really is. Most people in our industry have been forced through commercial pressure to look at what's happening this month or this quarter. Talking around the traps, very few people are looking at what their businesses are going to be doing in 6 or 12 or 18 months. Typically that's only C-level people for good reason as well. So sociologically, we need to relearn how we're going to do things. And there's the challenge, because it's not a collegiate industry. It just isn't. We all sing and we all dance and we all have fun at events together, but then we leave and we go away and we figure out, you know, we're battling other entities for the same slice of the 20% pie, rather than joining forces and thinking, how can we increase the size of the 20% pie? And there's the problem. Everybody's thinking, how can I get my share of the pie, rather than sitting around a table going, how do we make the pie bigger? And until we do, as a 20%, sit down and figure out what we're doing to increase the size of our pie. Plenty of these talking heads you see on panels and at events, they say Facebook this, Facebook that. However, they've all got a like button on their website. What's with that? What people say and what people do, those two things need to get far closer together before we see any movement in increasing the size of the 20% pie. Otherwise, it's still going to be a fight for, I'm the best SSP in the world. Well, how are you different to them? Well, we've got better t-shirts. You need to stop spending money on Google. Yeah, but they take me skiing twice a year. How do you compete with that? And there's the challenge, right? So who's got whose best interests at heart? I would suggest that most people, and quite rightly so, focus on themselves and their lives, what happens between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. during the day. That's what they have to focus on, because that's where we are as an industry. We're fighting to get more of the 20%, not fighting to take some of the 80% back off the duopoly.
Do you think, from an advertiser perspective, I'm just thinking back to my old media days, kind of there's a lot of ad tech companies out there now that have got great, I'm talking about the demand side more, got great agency relationships, a lot recognise that they need to go brand direct and they're trying to do that. Google have, and Facebook as well, have always done that to perfection. The way they're able to kind of usurp and kind of like just muscle their way in to get to the brands directly. And it feels like there's always been, from advertiser perspective, an element of trust with the likes of Google and Facebook, as in they trust what they're telling them and they don't trust the agency to tell them the same thing. So they'll go to Google and Facebook to get the truth. With independent ad tech, does it feel like that they're having to work harder to kind of build those kinds of relationships? Have Google and Facebook just been doing this better for a lot longer?
I think a lot of it has to do with lobbying and politics rather than just straight, hey, we really like Facebook or we really like Google. And to me, that's the crux of the matter. Facebook can walk into any company in the UK and fix a problem. They can, because they've got the scale, it's easy, and they can throw a boatload of tech, engineering, or cash at a problem to fix it. Most technology in the advertising industry is trying its best to do the right thing. But when you're faced with free trips to Marybelle every year for 30 odd people within an agency, how do you compete with that? And once again, it sort of harks back to the sociological challenge we as an industry do face. We need to re-educate most of the constituents if we're going to grow the 20%. And don't get me wrong, hey, the 20% doesn't necessarily need to grow. If people don't want it to grow, it never will. And it takes more than one or two tall poppies to move that 20% when you get... There's a lot of sycophancy in the industry. Everybody talks what's good and what's not good, but they don't change behavior. In a lot of instances in life, you need to recognize there's a problem before you can change that problem.
So I agree with Gareth, and it requires a lot of negotiating and brain power to kind of to map that out. But the easiest way to stop the rot is to not let them into channels that they are already out of. So I find it incredible that Disney would ditch their ad server for DFP. I find it absolutely, I think it's actually scandalous. I'm firing that person, whoever made that decision, and it's an utter disgrace. But the thing about Google is they're so flexible. Going back to your point, they're so flexible, right? They will use their muscle to be a little bit more open, and then as soon as they get people, they'll slam the door. So there's a rumor going around that Google are going to let third-party DSPs back into YouTube because they want the broadcasters using YouTube, right? So they've made a promise in Dublin that, off record, because I've heard through the grapevine, as I do with most Google things, that Google are going to open up YouTube to third parties because they want the broadcasters. But then you're saying, why would you do that? YouTube is competing directly with you idiot, right? And have you not seen what they did to your digital business? As soon as you let them in, they will own you. And this is not me railing against Google. They just are an animal, right? In the best, Google people are lovely people and the company's great, but it's an animal. All it wants to do is grow and grow, take more, right? And it has to control itself, because if it goes beyond the 20%, guarantee you there will be legislation. I think we're really at that threshold where if you start crossing that Rubicon, to borrow a phrase from the Rubicon Project, if you cross that Rubicon, there will be legislation. They cannot own 90% of the business. If they own 90%, they will be broken up because there will be no media left, right? We cannot have this situation. You know, it's the problem they have right now is the digital is going to slow down in terms of growth, right? And they're going to look for growth opportunities, Google and Facebook. Facebook's obvious route is to go into e-commerce. If it doesn't do that, it's done, because it can't take any more money from the ad ecosystem. It will take more, but it will be... This is what I actually think there's a buffer in the industry, right? The marketers will give so much money to Google and Facebook, but it doesn't do anything for their brand. It doesn't build a brand. Facebook and Google do not build a brand, right? What builds brand is premium content, out of home, TV, radio. That's where you build a brand, right? You don't build a brand in these platforms. So there's a buffer there. That's their buffer. They can't cross it. Facebook have tried to do Watch, their failed TV experiment. They're still trying to push. They'll push into e-commerce. What Google do will be interesting. Hence the reason why they're using ad tech as a battering ram to get into TV. Now, if you have any sense, TV companies, you will not let Google into the hen house. If, as soon as that happens, you're done. Forget about your business. Look what happened to digital. It's only a matter of time. So that would be my 2019 prayer. Do not let them into the hen house. Radio, out of home, keep away from Google. Do not let them actively go after your supply, because you will be finished.
Wise words there. Here on Arcane. I'm going to bring this back to something mildly positive. Looking back at the 20%, it's kind of a big success story within that has been AppNexus this year.
Oh. Yeah.
You're not expecting me to say that?
No, I think it's great. It's a great story.
It's great. But they were an example of independent ad tech that has been bought by AT&T. Another example of a telco's, you know, route to dominance, if you like. And then kind of within that, Xana has been created. Obviously, Brian Lesser was headhunted there for a very, very senior role. So it was kind of only a matter of time. Obviously, Kieran, you predicted that AppNexus would ultimately probably get bought by AT&T. He's shaking his head because it wasn't a strong prediction.
No, it was a drunken prediction.
The drunken prediction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but one that ultimately came true.
That's true.
But they're a good example, anyway, to not derail it completely. They are a good example of there is still growth opportunity. There is still strong M&A opportunity with ad tech. Yes or no?
So I won't dominate this one, because I just had a rant about Google, but the TV space is interesting, and I think that's where I as soon as you saw what AT&T were doing, they want to protect their own ad business, and they saw the writing on the wall many, many years ago. And obviously when Brian Lesser is probably the most impressive operator in our business, apart from Sir Marty, obviously, but Brian is the coming power in terms of like influence in the industry, and he saw how he could put all these assets together using amazing ad tech, which is what AppNexus is, and he's done that.
Yeah, I don't think it's too much discussion, really. Mr. Lesser nailed it.
He absolutely smashed it.
You know, those of us that have worked with Brian Lesser or know Brian Lesser knew he would. Incredibly humble. He knows his biscuits inside out.
Yeah.
You know, I worked with him at the Meg, which became B3, which then became Xaxis in the UK. And it was easy to see the guy was going to go all the way. And he has. He's future-proofed their business beautifully. There was rumoured that there'd be a mass exodus of premium publishers that were using AppNexus. Hasn't happened, won't happen. And it never will happen. Why?
Because it's a credible alternative.
Because they're an incredibly classy business. They're not ad tech people. They're not looking for an exit. They're not looking for A, B, and C. They're just looking to grow their business properly. And everybody knows that. I have absolutely no doubt that it will prove hugely successful for them.
And let's put it this way. AT&T are moving. They're being proactive rather than reactive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Randall Stevenson the CEO of AT&T? He obviously seen the various things have happened in digital, and he says, look, I'm not letting this happen. So hiring Brian Lesser was a stroke of genius. And remember, Brian was probably in line for the WPP role, right?
CEO. Without a doubt.
And the thing about Brian is that, you know, I've met him many times. He's just a sound man, and he's just a knowledgeable man. But the thing I liked about him, he also came from the upside of the business. Like, he understands the mechanism and the inner workings of ad tech, like, and how it relates to the business overall. And there's very few people at a senior level that have that insight that he has. But the thing about AT&T, which I find refreshing, is that they're a legacy company that has big ambitions, right? They are going to take that telephony data, and they're going to take all of the content assets they have, Time Warner, Turner. They have a massive footprint in Europe. Like, Turner is a big business here, and they've got CNN here as well. What they don't have is a mobile data. I have a feeling that AT&T may acquire a European carrier here. This is one of my predictions for the year. I think AT&T may look at Vodafone or O2 and say, we want the same business in Europe as we do in
they're launching
in the US.
5G. They're live, I think today, they're live in maybe 5 or 10 different cities with their 5G.
In the US?
Yeah, in the US. I think you're right. I don't think it would be a big step for them to come into Europe and swoop.
Yeah, Vodafone would be an interesting one. It's 35 billion market cap. So they pay a premium of 20%. So they're looking at 40 billion. it's got massive European coverage in the UK, Germany, France. It would be a really, really good acquisition. Or he could do the other players, sit down with all the telcos and say, look, it's us against them. Like, it's the duopoly in Amazon against us. Although if we don't do something, we're done. So he may do a deal with Orange. He may do he could work it that way. And this is where the app next thing. If you think about a scaled spine of ad tech, there's very few companies. There's no company like it, right? Brian O'Kelly, Mike Nolet, Rubenstein, all the sort of AppNexus top tier built a fantastic product, scale product that actually is as good as DFP, if not better, right? It was the only option to AT&T. I think the difference between them and Verizon is that Verizon were buying bits and pieces and trying to put it together. And that's a difficult bit.
Yeah, I think what AT&T realized is, Let's buy AppNexus and we know the total cost of what we're buying, rather than let's try and buy components with absolute unawareness of the soft cost of trying to link them.
Yeah.
As we've seen many times, and I was part of it when Blue Lithium was acquired by Yahoo, they buy a company and try and integrate it. It never works. You know, it just doesn't. And if it does, maybe seldomly. Whereas Mr. Lesser decided, no, I'm going to take the finished product and integrate that, because there's far less friction in bringing in another behemoth, an ad tech behemoth, into the AT&T world.
And it's an end-to-end stack.
Correct.
No integrations. You know what you're getting. Okay, it's a big outlay in terms of like capital expenditure to buy this company, but you're going to get every penny back, because all the roads seem to lead back to AppNexus in terms of what they're doing.
Absolutely.
It's probably the buy, as good as a buy, probably nearly as good as the purchase of DoubleClick by Google, I think. Because what it's done for one company, AT&T feels like an energized company. It feels exciting to work there. You talk to some of the AppNexus people, they're like a different person now since the acquisition. Feels like there's real energy, real ambition. And Brian, being the CEO, he just engenders a real confidence there. So I think AT&T is really in a really good place. I hear all the negative comments. I just think that's bullshit. But if you've got people at the very top, remember that Brian reports to Randall. There's no layer between, because Randall's betting the house in this. Then they're really all in. Whereas previous telco initiatives have been like, there's Tim Armstrong, there's somebody else, and there's the CEO of Verizon. CEO of Verizon leaves, and all he talks about on CNBC is 5G. Not about their amazing collection of content and ad tech assets.
Well, the big challenge with Verizon, of course, has been that they refuse to allow their data to go anywhere near the Oath platform. So that's obviously been a challenge.
I don't think that's the biggest problem.
They would have access to that.
I don't think it's the biggest problem. I think that could have been resolved. I think the fact that they don't have a unified brand or a unified ad tech stack is the biggest problem for them. And that's not me slagging off Oath, because it's a huge project, as Garrett said, to bring all these bits and pieces together and sort of, you know, make it one whole platform. Because you've got different code bases, different engineering talent. I mean, how does it scale? What is it saying? And they've got like four or five different DSPs on the mobile and desktop side. They've got, again, on the solid side as well. So they're very two different purchases. You can feel that AT&T has really nailed at this. I wouldn't be surprised if more purchases like this happen next year. We spoke about Vodafone there. They're massively protective about first-party data. Working with third parties in Europe is a bit of a legal minefield.
Well, it's interesting because you've got two different regulators. You've got telco, which is fundamentally, it's mature. It's been around for an awful long time. Everybody knows the rules. And then you've got essentially the digital world, which is up until GDPR, was a fundamentally unregulated banking industry. So when you've got companies like Vodafone or O2 that play both sides, they're a telco, but they're also a substantial digital business, it makes it super tricky for them. For them to pass PII from the telco business to the digital business is not simple.
But I think it's even more complicated when you have the ad tech ecosystem in between. Now, if they own the execution layer and the data management layer, it would become a lot easier.
They have to own it because they can't give...
Exactly. And that means, Gareth, they could probably do direct deals with publishers. Like, you know, that facilitates it rather than And then the GDPR compliance is within the Vodafone ecosystem, as opposed to here is a process or here is whatever. And that is just a minefield of legal shit show.
I want to talk briefly, and I say briefly because it's not going to happen, obviously.
But I find this very invigorating, by the way.
Good. I hope that's helped you. So the AT&T part, I want to talk about kind of, you know, if all roads lead to TV. We've talked a lot about kind of the big TV opportunity here. AT&T's purchase about Nexus and kind of the AT&T route shows TV. We had Jeff Green, the CEO of the Trade Desk, say on stage at ATS Singapore, you know, what the purchase of AppNexus by AT&T kind of, I guess, hammered home was everything we've been doing thus far has basically been a dress rehearsal for TV. And obviously, you know, OpenX announced recently they're getting rid of 100 staff members and they're shifting focus to TV and video.
Yeah.
Is audio visual where we're going to start seeing a shift to? And well, and how do we capitalize on this massive opportunity?
So 100%. Look, if you think about TV, it is the best brand building tool that's ever been created in this industry. It just is. Right, and the money will flow in that direction. I don't want to see the duopoly own that business because I think it'd be wrong. Because what Channel 4 and Sky and ITVs give us is something of a plural landscape, right? And the likes of RT in Ireland as well, and TV3, it just gives it a plural landscape in politics and entertainment. I do not want to see those core assets being, or that industry being controlled by a bunch of American companies. I think it's bad for our society. From an ad tech perspective, I think this is a huge opportunity because these companies are very forceful about keeping those guys at an arm's length. So there's a huge opportunity for independent ad tech to add value in that space. I don't know, what do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, my perspective is, what is TV nowadays and what's TV going to be in the years to come? Is it going to be a television that's connected completely? You know, are we going to get away from terrestrial TV entirely? Then the lines between TV and online blur, absolutely. So what I see is, I see us, you know, I hate to use the term omni-channel, but if TV and online are essentially the same thing, as soon as there's an ad server involved in there somewhere, they become the same thing. You know, there's no difference between the, what's that, 55-inch TV I'm looking on the wall and the 4-inch TV that I'm holding in my hand. They're the same thing. If the technology that delivers content to those become the same, then it's one world.
Yeah.
And that, to me, that's the 10-year game that the likes of Mr. Lesser are playing.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the thing about TV as well is there's the other channels like Out of Home, which is starting to find its voice again. Like, it went through a bit of a lull, but now it's starting to...
Yeah.
It's very exciting. There's, for all the doom and gloom in the industry, and let's be honest, in display advertising, it is a tough market. But in the channels that are what we would consider traditional media channels like Radio Out of Home and TV, there is a sort of renaissance around technology and data-driven buying, which is I find very exciting. And it offers a lot of opportunity for the 20%ers because that will increase... You talk about increasing pie. There's your increased pie
exactly.
There, you know?
So move away from the static and the downloaded to the moving and the streamed.
Think about the growth of podcasts. We obviously record more now, but I listen to more podcasts than I do radio. Like, so... It's a very exciting time. There's a lot of interesting companies in the space. And, you know, that's not just it. I'm you know, I advise a company called AnAdView, which do, they're basically building a tool to serve ads on airplanes because at the minute, show hall flights, it's just a lot of exciting opportunities. That's a whole new area that hasn't been touched yet. So it's TV is definitely the big one because it's still very concentrated in terms of the spend and the revenue. But it's a different game for Facebook and Google there. It's not user-generated content because I'm not going to watch
user-generated content. Well, it's content, isn't it?
It's real content.
I mean, Google you go to when you want to go somewhere else.
Yes.
So Google's a traffic light. Facebook...
It's a highway.
Well, you could call it a highway. You go to Google before you turn left and right. That's where you find your destination. Whereas Facebook is... I mean, I believe they said themselves they are a publisher. They said that in court. However, out of court, they're not a publisher. They don't publish anything. It's like chewing gum. It's my auntie Valerie in Ballymena posting about the fact the flowers are still out at this time of year.
That's beautiful.
It is lovely. Ballymena actually is quite a nice part of the world.
Ballymena, hey.
However, what's the power of the brands? Why would the brands need to be there? Brands don't advertise on Facebook because of the content. They do not. No. They advertise on Facebook because it's easy, because it's scalable, and because it's cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I think that they're going to struggle in what I describe as the branding echelon. Now that a data-driven aspect has been attached to it, and we're just talking about Brian Lesser and AT&T back there, it's a very exciting spot. You can see more money flowing that way. So maybe all is not lost.
Well, hopefully.
It's never all lost, but sometimes it's just hard to find.
Exactly.
I now want to switch over and start chatting about you, Gareth. So
is that all the stories for the year?
No, but look at the time.
But this is a lot. This is a Christmas special.
A bumper podcast. Well, okay, what else do you want to talk about?
Kieran, can you put the bottle of whiskey down, please?
Hold on. It's a bit early in the morning for that crack. Well, we covered GDPR.
Yeah, we have.
We covered the big exit of the year. We covered TV. We covered how much we all love Brian Lesser.
That's been well covered.
We covered the death of digital display and the growth of the new channels. Yeah.
We've covered single ID and measurements.
Oh, yes, that's a single ID. We covered a lot, actually.
We have covered a lot.
Yeah, actually, you're right.
There are more things we could talk about. What will blockchain do in 2019?
Oh, God,
yeah,
no.
I knew I'd get that reaction.
Blockchain.
So a no to blockchain, then. Yeah. No,
we're not talking about blockchain.
I've nothing to add on blockchain.
I will add that I actually made money on the Bitcoin surge. I sold early, got out early.
Well done.
Well done, Kieran.
Thank you.
There'll be many people that are probably angry to hear that now. Well, I'd imagine.
Suckers.
Yes.
Anyway, go on.
Let me just recenter. Okay, right. So there's nothing else we want to. There's probably plenty we could talk about.
Well, we could talk about WPP and the AIDS, but we've talked about death.
We've talked about Mark Read. We've talked about Sir Marty a lot over the past few weeks. Yeah. Not a lot has changed.
No.
It will be another interesting one to watch. I also was looking back over some of your predictions pieces, and you did say Sir Marty will buy AdTech.
Yes. Oh my God! I was right again.
Yeah.
Woo!
That's
class.
I thought you'd like that.
When did I publish that one?
Let me just have a little look here.
Yes, two. Actually, was Mighty Hive Ad Tech? I suppose it is.
This was the 10th of July.
Right, okay. Okay, I still think he'll buy more Ad Tech.
Without a doubt.
He's a long time listener. Hello, Sir Marty. Hope you're doing well.
Looking forward to having you at ATS London.
Yes, come to ATS London. We love you.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So we're good. We're good for year end review.
I think we've covered it really well.
Okay, so I want to chat about Seen This and what it is, what you're doing. Tell us everything.
Absolutely. Seen This, Stockholm-based. We're a Swedish company, privately owned.
That's funny. When Kieran came back from meeting you the other day, he said that you were finished. So great start.
I haven't even started yet.
No.
What?
I actually said you were in Helsinki, so I completely messed that one up.
I've certainly gone out and bought a few turtleneck sweaters to wear.
I would say, listeners, that I met Gareth downstairs in the Costa Coffee and I thought he was Swedish. He had big, thick black glasses and he had the polo neck. I was going, he looked very Scandi in his attire and his demeanour.
I'm proud to say, my newly adopted nationality of Scandi, it blends well with my Kiwi heritage and my Irish birth.
Great people.
Seen This, we're a creative technology company. We use adaptive bitrate streaming to deliver high quality videos into advertising space.
So,
good synopsis.
That's a good synopsis. So, let's dig a bit deeper.
Absolutely.
What does that mean for a typical advertiser? So, what obviously you're going to this company because it's addressing a big problem. So, what is the big problem it's currently addressing?
To me, the reason it was so attractive, it's an evolution, not a revolution of technology. up until seeing this, and there may possibly be others, I just don't know of them, if an agency wanted to execute an HD video buy, they had very limited places to go. They could go to a third-party creative studio, ad network, or they could go to a DSP creative studio, on that side, where why it's so attractive to me is you often hear the term win-win-win, and it's used far too much. Why I think seeing this is a win-win-win is adaptive bitrate streaming tailors or adjusts the bitrate of the packet of data being delivered to a user's device based on their own bandwidth that they've got available to them. So it's not downloading a massive file, it's hitting buffering.
It's great for emerging markets then, for example, that are very mobile first but haven't got the streaming
capacity. It's great for any market.
Those connected to the network as opposed to the Wi-Fi, yeah. Because that's obviously an issue with coverage.
Yeah, and on the advertiser side, let's look at rudimentary video delivery. If it's being delivered through a player, that massive multi-megabit file has to land on the user's device before it starts playing. What does that do to the user's data plan? And from a more sort of fundamental perspective, you're leveraging that user's money, their data plan, to drop your advertising on it. If that user watches a second and scrolls past, they've downloaded all of that data. They've spent that data getting to it. So what's the point in the advertiser doing that? So from a user experience perspective, it's spot on. Adaptive bitrate streaming breaks down, say, a 10 megabyte file into 2 to 4 second bursts. Each one of those packets of data has a manifest file on it. That manifest file looks at the bandwidth the user's got and then calls the bitrate, the file that is most appropriate to that user in that moment. From an advertiser's perspective, it means that their videos are viewed. It's not being buffered. It's all well and good to say we've got 90% reach of the entire UK market as a video ad network, but if the users aren't able to watch the advertising, who's winning? If you then take viewability and you put that into the mix, the video ad network says, well, we've got 90% viewability. What's being viewed, the ad unit or the creative? The beauty of seeing this and the streaming that we do is we're able to break down and report through to the advertiser how much of the stream video was viewed. So viewability takes on a whole new meaning. It's creative viewability. How much of a video, how much of a creative was viewed by the consumer rather than, well, the ad unit was displayed, therefore we can charge you. That doesn't work for the consumer. That doesn't work for the advertiser. From a publisher's perspective, similarly, it's giving them technology where they can take back control of their own video delivery. They don't need to rely on a player, therefore there's no wait there, there's no latency on the publisher's site. They're able to serve it out of an ad unit, whether it's an IAB or their own bespoke, doesn't matter to us. We can stream into it. So it's exciting times, and I've been in media for 20 years now, so it's lovely to not be in media, to be working with a company that's built from scratch, it's privately owned, and it solves a problem today.
So just go back to the adaptive streaming, is it?
Adaptive bitrate streaming.
So is there any latency issues around this? So when the page loads, are you loading in the background? So let's just say... Is your technology suited more for direct I/O buys as opposed to programmatic buys, or is there any difference?
No, it doesn't matter to us. We'll take a creative asset from an agency or a brand. We will do our magic with that, and we'll send them back either a tag or send them back a file.
Do you deliver? So your technology is effectively encoding this into a specific file. Which your system delivers, or you can deliver through DFP or whatever else?
It, two different things. We stream it. How it's delivered is up to the buyer. So it can work through every technology.
So the tag loads on the page, and you basically stream it into the ad unit. Okay.
Correct. So the ad unit belongs to the publisher. It's not a bespoke ad unit.
Right.
So they don't need to install a player. They don't need to integrate with us. There's no SDK involved. We're streaming into an ad unit that's already there today, or they can build a bespoke ad unit.
So, could be IAB ad unit, could be anything, or
any ad. No, absolutely, right. We're IAB approved, pre-approved.
All right.
So it's it's just technology. This is the point. It doesn't matter what media it's in. It doesn't need to be advertising. Right. We stream content for a number of different clients.
Right.
It's the streaming element of it. It's okay. That it's that sympathetic streaming of a creative or of content to a device based on what the user can take at that point in time.
Okay. So it's not a pre-roll though, is it?
No, not at all.
It's just sort of like a HTML5 ad, effectively. Like it could be graphic, it could be...
Oh, it's
or a video, it could be anything.
I mean, I've shown you a number of examples, and in the new year, we'll be putting a number of examples up. It's stunning.
Right. It looks great. I mean, the latency on the site was non-existent. It was quite...
Well, there's no latency. The thing with most videos, most video technology is a big old lump of data needs to download before it starts. Mm. Ours doesn't. It's between 6 and 49 kilobits every single packet. So every 2 to 4 seconds, those packets are being streamed. So there's no 1 meg, 2 meg, 10 meg that needs to download before anything happens. So there won't be the latency. The ad unit loads and it begins streaming. If the user moves past, the streaming stops. Why does the streaming stop? Well, it doesn't need to continue. You don't need to continue to leverage the user's data plan, and we need to be able to report to the advertiser when the streaming stopped. You know, what were the quartiles of streaming that they achieved? Rather than it was viewed, what was viewed? Well, the ad unit was viewed. That's no good for an advertiser.
Yeah. In terms of when you see like mobile sites load, there's always kind of a latency because the auction's probably taking place in the background, right? And then an ad loads. How long before that auction? Like, I'm just thinking from a programmatic point of view.
Sure.
How quickly could you that auction? And how can it be loaded quickly? Like, I mean, is it instantaneous then, or how does it?
By default, it is because it's streamed through. So in a typical auction environment, you'll have a header bidder. They go through their biscuits. They sort out what they're going to do. So header bidder. DSP wins, DSP's called, ad unit, ad is called, as the ad's called, it streams in. So there isn't an inverted commas download to occur before streaming begins. It's that 49 kilobit, max 49 kilobit packet at a time that loads.
So do we need a new box and a Lumascape for Gareth?
Probably.
I absolutely think it's justified.
Yeah, I agree.
I think like it addresses a huge issue, particularly mobile, because of these very things, and it kind of disrupts the system because you're walking around the outstream guys, the rich media guys who are kind of like have their own player, but then a lot of these players now are blocked by Google.
And they're going to be more so.
Yeah.
What it also does is it gives publishers and advertisers control, and right. Everybody talks about bring back control, la 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 la. It's hyperbolized ridiculously, but the best way to solve a problem is to give somebody the tools to do it themselves, rather than to go, hey, you've got a remnant problem, I can give you some money for that. Well, that doesn't help anybody. When we walk into a publisher and we can say, we'll do this for you on a CPM model and it's yours, the smiles are genuine. It solves a today problem. It's not, you need to believe me, and if you just pivot and you look at it through my filter, then you'll see my utopic self-service, one platform is this, that, and the other. It's not that. It's just tech.
Mm.
It's humble technology. We take a creative asset from an agency or a brand. We do our thing, and then we send back a tag or a file. The agency or the brand can buy however they want to buy. If they want to buy an IO, they can. If they want to buy programmatically, they can. Similarly, if a publisher doesn't want to, you know, put a player on the site with its own latency problems, but also then they're reliant on the video ad network or the third-party creative studio to go out and sell against it. From an advertiser's perspective, it's not the ad network model, right? It's not... You know, we've all seen the marketing. We've got players on these 100 sites. We've got 90% coverage in the UK. Well, when you want to do an after-action report, how many ads were displayed on site 1, 2, 3? Well, we're not going to tell you. We know this model, Kieran. We've played it for 20 years. It's just the ad network model. Ad networks fill a hole right now, and they're always valuable, and they always will be valuable. However, the world's evolved.
Do you think your model might evolve into a self-serve possibility where you can just go to the site, pay the X amount of money and encode it and then deliver it through your system where you charge on a whatever CPM basis or whatever the SaaS model you do? Do you think that would happen? Because obviously that would be quite interesting, because an agent can just basically programmatically really interesting then, because just basically it's delivery.
Yeah,
you can still have the auction and, the as you say, the biscuit, the biscuits in between.
Absolutely. Q2 next year we're launching.
Okay, cool.
It's a given. You have to. When I'm sitting here talking about sovereignty and giving back control, the last thing that as a business we want to do is
start an ad network.
Start an ad network.
Hello, it's the easy way to make money.
Our margins would go through the roof. I think what's I've lost my train of thought just for a second there.
You're just going to excite all the money.
Ad network.
Ooh, yeah. Ad network. Who doesn't want another ad network?
Yeah. But Q2 next year you're launching.
Yeah, we can't really talk about giving control if they still have if Kieran in that agency has to send Gareth at this technology company a thing and I do stuff and I send it back, that's not really giving back control. That's PowerPoint giving back control. We've all seen it, we all know it. You see it on the PowerPoints. What giving back control is having a suite of products that can be remote accessed by somebody. End to end, they do it themselves. We have a very simple business model. It's volume-based. We're a streaming company. That's how it works. Q2 next year, it'll be live. And that to me will be really a new epoch in HD video delivery in our industry.
And with the relationship you're having with publishers, I'm assuming it's allowing publishers to be able to then go and do more direct deals with advertisers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
not have to rely on a third-party tech.
No, exactly. Or it has to run through a player, it has to do X, Y, and Z. No, it doesn't. They can do what they want. It also means that a publisher can be empathetic towards a creative agency. You know, everybody knows videos are cooler than banners. They just are. Moving pictures beat static ones every day of the week. So it means that those creative assets, the video assets that a creative agency has spent a lot of time building and a brand has spent a lot of money creating, can be repurposed more. So rather than a static banner in an MPU, you can run that video. Why wouldn't you? It's common sense, right? We as humans prefer things to be moving. So interaction is higher. The entire industry knows video performs better than banners. So let's take the best of the banner world, which is programmatic, multiple different ad units, easy pagination from a publisher's perspective. From a brand's perspective, they spent the most money creating that video asset. From a user's perspective, it works better for me if I'm not paying for an entire file to be downloaded to my device. That's no good to me. You know, from a viewability perspective, we can report back how much of an actual creative was viewed, not whether an ad unit was viewed. The challenge for me, and viewability is a big one, is the current viewability standards work for ad tech. They don't work for the advertiser and they don't work for the publisher. They allow people to bill. They don't show how much of a streamed ad Gareth Holmes watched.
Very true.
On that note.
Yes, on that note, it's time to end our final podcast 2018.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you very much to Kieran.
Thank you, Lindsay.
And to our special guest, Gareth Holmes. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Lindsay. Gareth. Thank you, Kieran.
This is our last podcast. We're off for a week, so we'll see you back again in January. Happy holidays.
And, happy Xmas.
Happy Xmas. For people that aren't, you know, celebrating what? Xmas. Well, happy holidays.
It's Xmas, isn't
it? Hope you have a wonderful festive season.
Yeah.
Any other cliches you can come out with. And I will leave you this one word before I go. Nebulous.
Nebulous. Garrett's off to kill a few pheasants for Christmas, so he's on his way. He's looking at me. Bye-bye.